Chapter 32. Sisters and Mothers. The End of the World, 2012. Rachel's hand was a rock on my knee, so heavy, keeping me in my place. "Dina," she said, "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Dina, look at me." There was nothing but a void inside me. I hadn't come here for this. "I can't do this. I can't do this. I'm sorry." The past was the present, and those were my mother's words. The words she said when she knew she couldn't keep me. Everything kept looping around, unravelling. I stood. "I just need a minute. Just need a minute to myself." I walked woodenly on bare feet through the little cottage in Mandy's old clothes. Did I take them? I must have taken them. I wrote the letters after all. Couldn't be trusted with the truth, bad apple that I was. I lifted the latch of the back door and ran out into the storm. At the cliffside, the rocks were sharp, the mud slippery, the ground uneven. The wind was a wild thing, pulling, pulling. The rain fell in glass shards. Everything was so cold. Everything was screaming. Everything became this haunted darkness, this sharp cliff's edge, there, right there, my bare feet towing the line between ground and sky. Steep fall to the ocean below. Tempest tossed and foamy. The wind was fierce, pushing, pushing. One more step, and I'd be falling. One more step, one more push, and I'd be on the back of a bull on my way to Tir na n'Og. Wasn't that what was out here? Wasn't that why Mandy came? Isn't that what everybody else thought? Not that she'd made her way here to break a family curse, but that she'd come to escape it. The storm took a deep breath. The wind screamed. Only it wasn't the wind. It was me. I screamed my mother's name to the crashing waves, the cliff face hard and fatal beneath me. I screamed my mother's name to the sea. I didn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. Mandy was my mother. She wouldn't leave me like that. She had to be here still. She had to be here somewhere at the end of the world. A figure appeared on the rocks behind me, grey of skin and tangle-haired. I could barely see with the dark and the rain, but I saw her. Not a batty old lady dunking biscuits in her tea and watching reality TV. This was a real ghost, a real banshee. Her mouth was a wide ruin. She opened it to scream for me. I turned to run, to search the cliffside in the dark, to climb down if I had to find Mandy. To find my mother before the banshee could get me. But the banshee's voice stopped me. Not a scream, not a whisper, just a voice on the wind. "Dina," she said. "Dina, I see you. Step back. Come here." The rain clawed my skin. "Dina," said the ghost, "come away. Come to me." Like Mary Ellen so many years before me, I stepped back from the edge of the cliff and I walked toward the banshee. The rain was a curtain, blurring the world. I couldn't see. The barest, lightest touch of a hand. "Follow, follow," said the ghost. Tangle of curls and apple cheeks. "Follow, follow me." There was nothing to do but let her lead. The grey ghost. Or was she so grey? Did her hair not have a hint of red in the rainy darkness? Gestured at me to come. I stepped away from the cliff. I followed her around the back of the Banshee's cottage to an ancient, crumbling hovel, the ruins of which the three old sisters' house had been built around a century ago. The cottage and the ruins still shared a wall, the one closest to the edge of the cliff practically falling into the sea. The rest of the ruin had tumbled down, was only held up by a large, gnarled hawthorn tree that grew right over it, roofed it, provided shelter from the storm. The wind whistled through its branches. I knew at once what this place must be. The end of the world. The ruins of the cottage in which Gerald and Mary Ellen met in secret, in which Patrick, Julia's father, was conceived. The cottage near where Mary Ellen tossed the magic sapling to the crashing waves below. The cottage in which the curse began. My eyes took some time to adjust to the low light, to the impossible sight. At first, I thought my sanity might have cracked completely. But then I threw myself into Mandy's waiting arms. Instead of an explanation, Mandy told me a story. I shouldn't have been surprised, I suppose. The apple, after all, does not fall far from the tree. I stilled the sudden anger that was in me, the confusion and relief, the grief and fear. It was my turn to listen. The storm came close to hear it too. Here is what she told me.
Mandy was a restless child, with bright eyes and wild hair she had to be caught to brush. Catching Mandy wasn't easy. Her father tried it, tried grabbing at her hair and smacking her bottom, locking her in her room. Her mother tried it, tried cries and bribes and empty threats. The teachers tried it with punishments, prayers, and failed tests. The parish priest tried it with tales of temptation, damnation. The local boys tried it with kisses. None of it ever worked for long. Had her parents been any other parents, they would have understood Mandy to be a wandering soul, fast-acting and quick-thinking, would have known she had a precociousness that should have been nurtured, not scorned. But as it was, Mandy came of age in a family so focused on what others would think, they didn't stop to think of what was best for her. The first time Mandy ran away, she was 11. She made it halfway to Galway before the police caught up with her at the bus stop, told her to get off the coach and come with them. The second time, she was 13 and there were 4 friends with her. They lasted 2 days on a beach in Wexford before the money ran out and they came home, filthy and triumphant. For years, all Mandy heard were variations on, "Why can't you be more like your sister?" Mandy's sister was studious. Mandy's sister was still. Mandy's sister stayed silent in the face of emotional manipulation. Mandy thought her sister was the worst off for it, so Mandy kept on running away. She didn't know which boy it was, the one who got her pregnant the first time. She and a few friends had planned to spend that summer hulling corn in rural France, but by chance one of them had a relative who worked in an orchard close to London. They set off for England without saying much to their families and spent 3 magical months bunking one on top of the other, climbing ladders, picking apples from the sun-drenched trees, and taking the train to London on the weekends to party their wages away. There were deer in nearby forests that screamed in the night, woke her up, heart racing, hands clutching her chest. There were strange silver foxes that no one ever saw, but that left long grey hairs caught on her windowsill in the morning. There was something strange about the orchard, Mandy thought, something magical. she listened to the tales told by the owner's grandparents about a mysterious sapling that had grown up overnight to feed the cravings of a starving pregnant woman, a witch perhaps, or some kind of mythic queen. Mandy took it all in, wide-eyed and full-stomached, crunching on apples she knew were not magic, but that she craved deliriously nonetheless. It was there that Mandy realized she was pregnant. 6 months along, according to the doctor. She just thought she was getting fat. She had no idea who the father was, and she didn't care. She came home with a daughter, a small, squalling, milk-drunk secret, a few months after her 17th birthday. A wonderful secret, a beloved secret, an impossible secret that belonged only to her that she took into her family home and shared joyously with her parents. Mandy's parents did not agree with her opinion. It did not take them long to wear her down, to employ every trick in their arsenal they'd ever tried before, denying and threatening, screaming and smacking, crying and bribing and locking her in. "You've no money to your name to raise her," they said. "You'll get no charity from us. She'll grow up knowing her ma's a little slut," they said. "Never worked a hard day in her life, doesn't even know the father. She'll be shunned, you mark my words." "You've no business raising a baby," they said. "You're barely more than a baby yourself. No schooling, won't graduate. What kind of a life do you think you can give a child, you selfish, ungrateful wretch?" There was nothing to do but follow their lead. For the first time in her life, Mandy listened to her parents, let them make her decisions, let them claim her child as their own. "It's in her best interests," they said. "It's for the baby. We're only doing this for the baby." "Her name is Dina," Mandy said. It was too much for Mandy. The screaming and sleepless nights and days, the coos and sickly smiles of the neighbours, the extended family, the exclamations over this miracle, this baby girl, Mandy's little sister. She slept fitfully, woke even when the baby slept, to discover that she had clearly been scratching at her skin in her sleep. Soon her body was covered in raised red lines running up and down her arms and legs, her torso, her chest, even her neck. Some morning she awoke to find them on her face. So when her mother fell ill, was hospitalised, slipped into a coma, Mandy did the only thing she knew to do. Running away had always been how Mandy faced her problems. She was drinking in a bar in Galway when she met him, Jeremy Nolan. He believed her lies. They all did. But he, unlike most of the others, was kind. He listened. He cared. She lost herself in him for a time. Then her mother died and she ran away all over again, with raised red scratches all over her pale, freckled skin and her belly slowly swelling for the second time. In the next 9 months, Mandy's belief in the curse became something real. A pip inside her that grew into a spindly skeleton tree. "What else," thought Mandy, "could this hellish year have been? How else could so much be stacked on top of the one person, the one family?" "My father was right," Mandy decided. "The Rice family name is cursed. My daughter will be better off without it. Better off without me." When her second daughter was born, she nursed her for a month, then wrapped her warmly in her car seat and left her on her father's front porch. This one she was sure of. This one had a family outside hers. It was the right thing, Mandy told herself over and over throughout the years. Ida was a Nolan, not a Rice. She was good. She was safe. The curse could never come to her. But as for the first one, the first baby, Mandy was forever torn.
Mandy showed up at Rachel's door on a Wednesday morning early, straight from the airport, tired and haggard, her clothes wrinkled and musty, with only a backpack and 50 quid to her name. She hadn't seen her sister in 5 years. She stood on the front step and listened to the sounds coming from inside. The doors opening, wardrobe drawers closing, 5-year-old feet clattering about in tiny shoes. Rachel's voice came through the closed door, firing off instructions and reminders, brisk and practical, telling the child off when she was too slow, saying they were going to be late. "Hurry up now, Dina. Get your coat on, quick as you can." Rachel opened the door to leave the house before Mandy could ring the bell. She stopped on the threshold, Dina, me, ahead of her, the tiny coat of my school uniform hanging by one sleeve, Rachel still wrestling with the zip of my oversized school bag. The zip shut with a sound like a tear. Mandy tried a smile, sank down onto her haunches, and stared into the face of her younger sister. "Sister," she told herself again and again, "sister," and said, in a voice made faint by love and guilt, regret and exhaustion, sorrow and relief, "Hi, Dina." I had never, to my knowledge, seen Mandy, but I recognised her. Rachel had made sure of that. Whatever resentment she had for her sister, she tried to put to one side. She told me stories of her childhood with a twin sister, the wild one, the one off on wonderful adventures. The walls of our house were covered in pictures of the lot of us, Rachel and me, Mandy, our dead mother, our absent father. I recognised them all. I shoved my arm into the remaining sleeve of my coat, shrugged, said, "Hi, Mandy. Are you coming to stay?" Mandy's eyes met Rachel's. Her sister's mouth was a thin line. "We're going to be late for school," she told me. "Give your big sister a hug and hurry up and get in the car." Mandy only let go of me when I pulled away, waved cheerfully at her, skipped over to the car and threw my school bag in. Mandy stood. "So," she said to Rachel, "I'm home." Rachel locked the front door behind her, readjusted her handbag on her shoulder. "It's been 5 years," she said, face impassive. The slightest warmth came through the stiffness of her words. "It's good to see you." "Sorry I didn't call to say I was coming." Rachel looked toward the car, to Dina, to me, fastening my seatbelt in the back seat. "How long will you stay?" Mandy took a breath. "I'm home," she said again. "I'm home for good." They both watched the small child in the car open her school bag and sneak a snack from her lunchbox. Watched me. Mandy could tell that her sister was also surreptitiously watching her, taking in her unkempt clothes, her tangled hair, the one backpack she'd brought with her. Mandy knew she didn't look like someone who was home for good. Still, she asked, "Can I have a key?" Rachel took a breath. "You know you can't stay in the house." "Rachel, Dad won't have it. And besides, Dina and I have our routine. I can't let you disrupt that if you're just going to disappear again for half a decade. I have Dina to think of. Her home, her stability." Mandy felt as though she had been kicked hard in the stomach. "Rachel, Dina is my..." Rachel cut her off. "I know," she said. "She's your sister too. Which is why I know you're going to do what's best for her." There was so little left of Mandy. She was raw, ragged, a cursed thing. "You can stay a couple of nights," said Rachel, unlocking the door for Mandy. There are towels in the spare room. The bed is made. There's a lasagna in the freezer or leftover spaghetti in the fridge. I don't think Dina ate all the scones. There should be a couple in the bread bin. Take a shower. Eat something. You look like you need a decent meal. I'll pick up a paper to find you a flat share if you're set on staying in Dublin. I'll get some money out to help you set up. But you can't stay here, Mandy. I don't need your money, Mandy said, temper hot, words like bullets. And I don't need your charity either. But I will see my daughter. Rachel shushed her, looked with panic again toward me. Her shoulders slumped. Her voice grew weary. I'm not a wicked witch, Mandy, keeping the child locked in a tower. But I have been raising her alone for the past 5 years. Alone, Mandy. Mandy looked deflated. Rachel took out her car keys, made a move to leave. It's good to see you, she said again, touching the handle of the car door. It's good for Dina to see you too. But show me that you can stay. Prove that you can be still. And then we'll see. But being still was never something Mandy was good at. And wavering from her rules was something Rachel could not do. Chapter 33 Sisters and Mothers, Part 2. The End of the World, 2012. So Mandy remained as my sister, my fairy godmother, my flighty but loving kin. And at the same time, Mandy dug deep and muddy, got her hands dirty, asked for favours and uncovered secrets. Mandy researched our family curse without knowing that she could one day break it. That she could one day make sure her daughters never had to change their true selves, damp down, pretend. Never had to live in fear. Mandy did her research, coaxed rumours from our family. With what she found, she was able to speak to Lizzie, who knew Julia's story. To old classmates of William's who knew his. She was able to trace the family tree to an old burnt-out cottage, found its history in the skull of the bull. There were letters, things Mary Ellen had left for her granddaughters, so they would know where they came from. A journal that Lizzie left to lie with the bull. And there was Mary Ellen's magic. The memories she spoke to the bull made manifest for when her ancestors would need them. But for all the beauty and sadness, all the wisdom in Mary Ellen's story, Mandy couldn't find anything concrete about the woman. Didn't know where she'd come from, couldn't find a record for a rice man who had died of diphtheria in Donegal, which is what was still widely believed had happened to her husband. But in Mandy's travels, somebody gave her a phone number for three sisters by the name of Boyle. Said they might know, had lived in the area Mary Ellen had said she was from for years. Three old sisters, they said. Might be relatives, might be family, you never know. When she spoke to the old Boyle sisters, Mandy understood. She pieced together their talk of local history that said that many years ago, the big house, long since rebuilt as a spa hotel, was still inhabited by a landlord, a wealthy Englishman named, what was it again? Rice? Rumour had it he'd impregnated a peasant, then evicted her whole family. She had left, never to be seen again. And from that moment, the landlord's family fortunes were ruined. The big house fell into disrepair. The Englishman's father was forced to sell his orchard. Nobody knew what had happened to the peasant girl. Nobody ever knew what happened to peasant girls. But Mandy did. And now she knew from which cliffs the peasant girl had thrown her lover's sapling. She now knew where the curse began. Suddenly, she had it. The Rice family curse, the three banshees, the reason all of those bad apples had been shaken off our fallen family tree. She understood how to break the curse. It all came from the sapling. The magical rice russet, the lucky lendemain. What had Gerald's mother told him all those generations ago?
The juice of these apples runs in your blood. Plant the tree on your land and your children's blood shall run with it too.
That was what Gerald had failed to do. That was what Mandy had to do now. And she set off to find it. To find the sapling. Mandy believed there was a curse on our family. But for the longest time, she didn't think to break it. She didn't believe it would ever hurt quiet, nerdy Dina, Rachel's protege. She didn't imagine that it could reach Ida, so far from our family. A Nolan, not a Royce. For all her research, she didn't understand that the curse didn't work like that. Nobody was immune from being branded. Bad apples, the lot of us. But she understood that soon enough. The moment she knew I had inadvertently come out to my father, she knew the curse would come to me too. Mandy did write one of the letters. The note she left on her bed before she disappeared. I was the first to read it. But already her tear stains had blurred the words. I had missed a single letter at the end of the last word. A crucial letter. A letter that changed everything. Daughter. Daughters.
Going to the end of the world. Give all my love to my daughters.
I suppose my mother was never quite sure she would return. I suppose that was why she wrote the note, left her bedroom pristine, her things tidied, her loose ends tied. It seemed an impossible task. For all my mother knew, the sapling had been thrown into the Atlantic, left to rot at the bottom of the seabed, seaweed tangled, fed by salt and bleached seal bones. But something pushed Mandy onward. Guided her car to the cliffs just over yonder, close to where our ancestor once lived and loved and was betrayed with her unborn son swirling in the depths of her. Three voices urged my mother on. Cliffs are a bitch to climb backward. Hand under foot and foot over hand, she scaled them down, down. Trying to keep from falling. She could see something far below, farther than most had ever thought to look, to search, to photograph. A sharp jut of rock and a dark spill of soil, so unlike the muck and mud of the cliffs. And, at its edge, a branch. Not a peace offering, not a laurel. A thin and spindly, barely living tree. But it was alive, after all these years, impossibly. It lived. Mandy scrambled to reach it. Her footing grew erratic, her blistered hands sore. Her muscles screamed surrender. The sea was stormy, the wind was fierce. One gust was all it took. She fell. Perhaps she slept. Perhaps she died. She couldn't tell. The three old women told her, after, that they'd found her. Found her car parked by their cliff. They didn't hold to notions like national parks. No, this land was their land, bound to their family name. Found her lying half alive by the remains of an apple tree. Miles and miles down the rock and steep slope, the breakneck fall of the storm-swept cliffs. How the three old biddies dragged her back up was a mystery, but Mandy suspected it involved a rope, a pulley, and a great grey bull. She came to in a cottage with a thatched roof and whitewashed walls built from the ruins in which her ancestors met, secretly, in the night. She'd been out for days, out of time, out of mind. "Rest," said the old ladies. "Recuperate. Gather back your strength." Their voices sounded familiar. She allowed herself to trust them. When she was well enough to get up from the slouchy couch in the cottage living room, Mandy had connected it all. She slipped out of the house in the dead of night and walked for miles through the darkness to take the nearest bus to Dublin. She didn't imagine they'd have buried her. Them, her family, the ones who'd known how many times she'd run away before, who hadn't batted an eyelid, who'd barely called the guards. The family that thought she was dead. How would you know if you were dead? Could you feel it? As an ache, a physical sensation that left behind a hole inside you? Could you sense it as a smell, salty like the sea, or tart like apples? Would you know it in the way you somehow know you were asleep in dreams? Nobody seemed to see her. She was sidestepped by pallbearers, looked over by the blank-faced family, assumed to be a distant relative from out of town. After walking all the way into said town in a storm of rain, umbrella-less, childless, lifeless, the only person who saw her could well have been a ghost herself. A mirror reflection, sitting up by the angels on O'Connell Street, looking like the sisters, the daughter and the sister she had supposedly left behind. Mandy began to doubt herself. She had a lump on her head the size of a hen's egg, and her extremities were still tinged blue in the cold. Nobody saw her. Nobody looked at this woman, bedraggled, drenched, shivering in the downpour. Maybe the mourners were right. The priest on his pulpit, the newspaper print in black and white. Maybe Mandy Rice had died on that cliff. Maybe she was a ghost after all. On the bus back to Donegal, no one would meet her eye. She passed through their vision as though she were invisible. And whether it was because she looked wretched or because she was just a ghost, she couldn't tell. Could dead women break curses? Did ghosts have any more stories to share? Mandy sneaked back up to the cottage, searched the whole place when the banshees were away. When she heard them coming, carrying something heavy between them with difficulty and great care, she hid under the tree in the old ruins behind their house at the edge of the cliff, the ancient crumbling cottage from which her family curse had come, with nothing but the knowledge of everything she had done wrong. And a spindly, ancient, half-alive tree in the corner, lopsided in a cracked clay pot. Mandy barely had time to touch the tree when the cliffside called to her. "Mandy! Mandy!" A wailing on the wind. "Follow! Follow!" Mandy followed, and in the dark, she found me, the only one screaming and screaming her name. Chapter 34. Le Lendemain. The End of the World. 2012. Beside Mandy, beside us, was a small tree. Damp leaves, dull bark, soil half spilling out of a cracked clay pot. "It's the sapling," I whispered. "It's the Rice family curse." "Le lendemain," said Mandy. "The next morning." However long a life story takes to tell was the time it took them to find us. We were in the last place you'd think to look. A tumble-down ancient ruin, roofed by a gnarled hawthorn tree, facing nothing but the edges of cliffs and the sea. But they found us. Three banshees stood silhouetted in the storm. They were family. They were ghosts. They were ancient battle goddesses. They had the answers. They were the keepers of the course. Three grey ladies, screaming the voices of those who could not speak, scratching their limbs to wake them, warn them. The screams of new babies in the air, blood on the sheets, blood on clean knickers, girls bending their backs over heat and steam and dangerous machines, washing, always washing the blood from their clothes. Girls alone in overseas hotel bathrooms, bleeding bright red on new pajamas, washing the bottoms under hotel room taps, washing, always washing, bleeding, always bleeding, left alone to wash and bleed. And where did that leave me? That left me in the trembling arms of my mother, who shielded her eyes from the glare of the banshee's flashlight beams. The three witches clicked their tongues. They said, "Well, there you are," as if we'd only stepped out for a bit of air and a chat. "Come on back inside. The open door will let the heat out." They sounded so certain that there was nothing strange about our situation that we followed without a word. The hallway between the little kitchen and the main room was tight, was narrow, could only fit one body at a time. The first banshee led us, followed by me, followed by the second, followed by Mandy, followed by the third. At the sound of our footsteps, I could hear the others rising from the threadbare couches, upsetting the rickety coffee table, spilling the tea.
"Did you find her?"
Rachel's voice was raw and ragged. She sounded like an old woman. I knew I was wet by the way my hair hung cold and heavy against my cheeks, with how Mandy's sweater was a weight on my chest, by how I could barely feel my feet. There was a strange, loud clicking sound reverberating around the cottage, which I realised with a shock was coming from my chattering teeth. Rachel ran over with the bull hair blanket, bundled me close to the fire before sitting right in front of me, looking at me and smacking me once hard across the cheek. Then she grabbed me and held me to her heart so tightly, the heat of it warmed me better than the turf fire, spluttering with occasional raindrops in the hearth. I tried to push myself away, but still she held me.
"Rachel, what the fuck?"
My voice was muffled, cracked, barely angry.
"You hit me."
It had felt less like a blow, and more like the kind of smack you'd give somebody who'd fainted. A wake-up call, a return. Still, it smarted in more ways than one.
"I was sure you jumped."
Her voice was as muffled as mine, lost in the thick tangles of my hair.
"I was sure you'd followed Mandy. After everything I said, you don't do that. You don't just fucking run out into the storm and off a cliff. You don't do that."
I finally untangled myself from my sister, aunt, from my aunt.
"I didn't do that."
I gestured down at my body, cold, yes, but also clearly alive.
"Obviously."
Finn knelt beside me. His eyes were red, ringed with deep shadows.
What were you doing out there then? He asked. I realized I had scared him.
I went to find Mandy.
Dina, he said.
And I did.
Dina.
Rachel saw something in my expression that stopped her, made her hold out a hand to cut Finn short. Wait, she said. You what?
As if she had only been waiting for her cue. Mandy stepped out of the hallway. How do you react? Seeing a sister you thought had died. A sister you'd buried. Had barely begun to mourn.
It had been 3 days since Mandy's funeral. Just over a week since she disappeared.
Edith's mouth hinged open and her eyes filled with tears.
Finn rubbed his own eyes as though the appearance of a dead woman was some kind of speck in his vision, a trick of the light.
Cale moved closer to him on the couch, bent to whisper in his ear.
Rachel stood. Where were you? She said.
Here. Mandy's voice shook. I've been here.
Are you going to explain why you let us all think you were dead?
Mandy pressed her lips together in a gesture so reminiscent of her sister, it made me catch my breath.
I'm going to explain everything, she said.
Mandy told her whole story again, history repeating itself over and over in the main room of the tiny cottage. And, as she spoke, the storm died slowly. The wind stopped wailing. The rain stopped dripping in through the cracks around the windows. The three banshees floated into the living room, shared the longest couch. Rachel stood in front of the fire, with me at her feet like a cat.
A concussion, she said flatly when Mandy was done.
Why then didn't these three call me? Were they concussed too?
She nodded sharply at the banshees, who bared their sharp teeth. Mandy leaned against the wall of the doorway, still not quite with us in the room.
I didn't have my phone, she said. Or my mind, really, if I'm honest.
I'll say, Rachel mumbled.
She sat and poured out more tea, then switched suddenly and inexplicably into her usual bustling self.
Would you ever come in and get warm, Mandy? Look, you're soaked to the skin. There's room in front of the fire with Dina. Here, have some tea. Hand around the cookies, would you, Ida? Mind you don't spill crumbs off the plate.
Ida knelt at Mandy's side and offered her a cookie. Her hand trembled, and the plate shook crumbs into the moth-eaten carpet. Mandy took her daughter's hand instead of the cookie.
Hello, Ida, she whispered. Hello.
Ida's voice was quiet, hesitant, unlike the cool, blunt way of speaking I thought was her usual and had only just about become accustomed to. This wasn't the tear-filled embrace of a reunion I had been expecting. At that moment, I realized that endings are rarely ever endings. I had come all this way, we had come all this way, me and Ida, to find our mother. And we had. Ida had never really met her mother before. I had been told from birth she was my sister. For us both, Mandy had been dead for almost a week. For Ida, she was already twice gone, and how could she be sure her absent mother wouldn't just leave again? In the end, this didn't feel like an ending at all.
So this is it, I said. The stories have been told. This must mean that the curse is broken.
Rachel didn't ask what I meant. Her eyes rested on the pile of letters on the little coffee table, and I understood that she had read them when Mandy and I were out in the storm. We were on the same branch now, the lot of us. We'd climbed all the way up our family tree.
Almost. Three voices spoke at the same time, hitting each syllable like a single set of vocal cords, one mind branched into three. Takes more than a cup of tea to break a curse. You're a family, said Rachel. Aren't you? Like Mandy said, relatives of Mary Ellen's. Yes, replied the banshees. And no. Finn stood and took an envelope from the windowsill, which was covered in keys and hairbrushes and toothpicks, things dug out of pockets. He held it up. It was a bill of some kind, addressed to a Ms. Boyle. World's End, Donegal. Ida let out a small laugh. Going to the end of the world, she quoted. Where else? Said the banshees. What else would you call this place? Outside the window, dawn swept over the cliffs, shining on the raindropped cobwebs, the spindly fallen trees, the flooded rocky fields. The wilderness stretched forever on every side but one, and on that side there was only ocean. So you are Boyles, like Mary Ellen, said Ida. See, Dina, they aren't banshees. There's always an explanation. And not a supernatural one, Rachel said. There are no banshees. You don't really believe that. She gestured toward the three old women. They don't actually believe they're banshees anyway. Oh, don't we? The banshee's eyes wrinkled with mirth. Who do you believe you are? What do you mean? We meant what we said. Who do you believe you are? Rachel sighed, said patiently, I'm just me. Exactly, the three grey ghosts said together. You don't have to believe in who you are. You just are. Together, they grinned. They were no great-great-aunts of ours. They were witches. They were goddesses. They were three banshees ready to scream our deaths, to warn us, to help us. So the same thing that happened to the bad apples of our family didn't keep on happening again and again. My mother was not my mother. My sister was really my aunt. The girl I thought was my niece was my sister.
Going to the end of the world. Give all my love to my daughters.
Here we were now, together at last. Here at the end of the world. The storm had died down as quickly as it had come. We stepped out of the cottage into a calm, still day in which bright, shining puddles reflected the blue of the sky. Pathetic fallacy, said Finn, is when the weather reflects the mood of a play or a story. Sometimes it's nothing but a metaphor. A girl walks sad and lonely in the rain. Sometimes it's an omen. The storm signals a battle about to be won. The past could be the present. My best friend's words could have been mine, spoken at a funeral for my elder sister, who turned out to be my mother and not really dead at all. Maybe the storm isn't a battle, I said. Maybe it just represents confusion. You battle through it to the truth.
You battle through it,
the three banshees said in their eerie synchronicity. Mandy and Rachel and I said,
We all do.
From the ruined cottage, we took the sapling. It had lived for over 100 years alongside our family history, waiting to be found. To be rescued, to be planted. It'll never work, said Rachel, watching me and Mandy fetch shovels from the shed. This land is barren. It's all rock and sand. The air is salty and harsh, and the wind is almost constant.
Some apples like that,
said the banshees, watching from the arch of the kitchen door.
That's exactly the kind of air some apples need.
We carried the tree to the cliff where I had stood just hours before, where Mandy had started the long climb down last week, where Mary Ellen had tried to destroy it over a century ago. We kept well away from the edge and stuck our spades into the hard land as if to dig a grave. We kicked at the old clay pot that housed the sapling until it shattered under all our feet. We lowered the spindly trunk into the hole, threw earth over its roots, patted it down until there was black, sandy dirt under all our fingernails, like we dug up treasure, a long-buried secret, a family curse. We stood back, breathless and salty with sweat. The sea air was on our lips and our tongues, but was soon replaced by an overwhelming smell of apples. The sapling took root. Within minutes, as we stood in a circle and watched in disbelief, the rice russet, le lendemain, grew into a tree. It takes about 7 years to grow an apple tree in the right conditions. This one shot up at our feet. The trunk widened, the branches multiplied, broke into buds. The buds flowered and grew apples large enough to harvest.
That's impossible,
breathed my family.
Now,
said the banshees, coming in a cluster from the door of their cottage.
Now the curse is broken.
The juice of these apples runs in your blood, said Ida. Plant the tree on your land, and your children's blood shall run with it too. As one, Mandy and Rachel stretched an arm out to pick an apple each from the bottom branches of the tree. They were tall, but had to stand on tiptoe to reach them. Mandy handed hers to Ida, Rachel hers to me. They were the perfect mix of tart and sweet. They tasted like every story in our family history. They tasted like endings.
So this is how you break a curse, said Finn, impressed, eyes wide and arms folded,
watching us.
Oh no,
said the banshees together.
Not really.
I threw an apple underarm to Cale, and it landed straight in the palm of her hand. Ida grinned and tossed one to Finn. The banshees clustered around Rachel and Mandy, and the unlikely lot of us shared the apples from our family tree. We were connected, all of us, by blood and beyond blood. Cale's ancestor and mine had been lovers. Finn and I became best friends because we were both queer. Ida seemed like a nice, normal girl on paper, but Mandy was her mother. Maybe we were all bad apples, no matter what we did. But maybe it wasn't just us. There are no bad apples, I said into the crisp, sweet silence. Are there? The three banshees grinned with all their teeth.
Now you're getting it, they told me.
What do you mean?
Said Mandy. I mean, this isn't just our family. It's our whole country. Cale's ancestor, Anne Gorman, was thrown out of her home for whom she loved. The same would have happened to Cale. If Finn was born 100 years ago, he'd have been an outcast too. You don't hear of many biracial, bisexual boys in Irish history. But I bet there are stories like these in almost every family. As you said the day you left, if you considered rotten by the rest of the family, by the rest of society, you're doomed. Rachel threw her apple core over the cliffs and into the sea. The past just keeps on repeating itself, she said. The banshees grinned as though we'd made them proud, as though this was a conclusion they had been leading us toward all along. The curse isn't on our family, I said slowly, thinking as I spoke, speaking with more than just my own voice. It's on every woman in this country, kept in shame and silence for generations, kicked out, locked up, taken away. Their children sold in illegal adoptions, their babies buried in unmarked graves, forced pregnancies and backstreet abortions, 11 a day on the boat to England, only to come home to rejection and stigma, insults and prayers and keeping up appearances. And how do you break a curse like that? We were all crying again, the lot of us. Our tears salted the earth and fed the tree, made the apples taste like the sea. You tell the story, said Mandy slowly. You tell your story and the story of your family. You speak your truth. You shatter the stigma. You hold your head up to the world and speak so that everyone else who was ever like you can recognize themselves. Can see that they aren't alone. Can see how the past will only keep repeating itself as long as we're kept powerless by our silence. Yes, said Rachel, stunned. Yes. I wrapped an arm around Rachel's waist, and Ida tucked herself under Mandy's shoulder. Our family tree, in full bloom. Heavy with good, ripe apples, swayed, deeply rooted, in the salty sea breeze. Chapter 35. How to Break a Family Curse. Dublin, 2012. When we got home, funeral flowers still crowded the porch. Our fridge was full of food left over from the wake, the homemade quiches and shepherd's pies, the tarts and bakes, stale sandwiches still cut into triangles, wilted lettuce lolling out of them like tongues. The neighbour's curtains twitched as we walked up to the front door. Loud gasps sounded from behind them. Turned out, it was a bit embarrassing when Mandy showed up at the door. I tried not to smirk too deeply as I gloated. When word got back to the family, our phones rang off the hook. We silenced the ringers and helped Mandy unpack her boxes into what had been the spare room, but was now her room. Her father be damned. Her shoes cluttered the floor, and her cigarette ash dusted the window sills. Her hair mingled with ours in the shower drain. When they received no answer, the family came knocking. Perhaps they expected to find Mandy filthy and matted, covered in earth, fingernails broken and bleeding from having scratched her way out of the grave. Instead, she opened the door halfway through breakfast in jeans and a t-shirt, holding a slice of toast in one hand. So it's true, the family said in wonder. Rachel appeared behind her sister, reached around her, and slammed the door in the gawping faces of our family. Mandy's laughter followed them back down the garden path. When our father came, we were ready for him. He didn't ring the doorbell, just let himself in with his key. In the kitchen, Rachel was making breakfast. Mandy was at the table on her laptop, alternating, typing furiously and swearing at the hold music on her phone. Having been dead for a week was turning out to be a bureaucratic nightmare. I was attaching a rainbow pin to the collar of my school shirt. We heard his heavy footsteps in the hall, but didn't look up. He stood in the doorway for a long time before speaking.
What do you think you're playing at?
Was the first thing he said to the daughter he thought had died. Mandy tucked her phone between her shoulder and her ear, finished typing two-handed. Trying to get my license renewed, she said,
Hi, Dad.
One of the three of you is going to tell me what's going on right now.
It was all a mistake, I told him. Mandy isn't dead. Clearly. Or else she's currently the world's most boring ghost.
Ha! Said Mandy.
Will you have some eggs? Rachel asked our father.
Her father. My grandfather.
I'm making bacon too, or you can have some of that squeaky Greek cheese Dina likes instead. Our father's face got progressively redder. A volcano about to erupt.
I don't want fucking cheese, he bellowed. I want you to tell me what the slut is doing in my kitchen.
Silence fell like a cast iron pan on the stovetop. Rachel took a breath, cracked another egg. It's not your kitchen, Dad, she said calmly. If you don't want breakfast, you can just have coffee. And if you only want to insult us, you can leave. I have to drive Dina to school in 15 minutes. I'd advise you to take that time to talk to your elder daughter. Aren't you happy to see me? Asked Mandy. Our father's face was a traffic light, a stop sign, a warning.
I'm happy to see you didn't kill yourself, he said. But your blatant disrespect is...
Wow, said Mandy.
The bar's set low.
There, I said. My pin's in place. What do you think? The pins were a late birthday present from Cale, who had sent them by mail the moment she got home, in an envelope sealed with a purple lipstick kiss. One was an enamel rainbow flag. The other was a round pink badge that said, Polite Young Lesbian. I took a picture to send to our group chat, even though my face was burning with the force of my grandfather's gaze, even though my hands were shaking at the thought of wearing them to school. My grandfather spluttered. The red of his face deepened to purple. He didn't seem to be able to speak.
Finally, he choked out, This isn't over.
When he left, he slammed the door. My heart hammered like the reverberations. Well, that's it. We can kiss this house goodbye. Oh, don't be silly, said Rachel, soaking the frying pan before sitting down to eat. The house is in our name, as per Mum's will. And right now, I'm changing the locks. 15 minutes later, Rachel pulled up at the school.
You sure you're ready for this? Mandy asked from the front passenger seat.
Nope.
That's the spirit. Knock 'em dead.
I straightened the pins on my shirt collar and walked into the school hall 10 minutes early for Friday assembly. I had lost my invisibility. A crowd of eyes watched me.
News spread fast, and it had been 5 days since my sister had returned from the dead.
I messaged my friends a running count of the whispers and rumours until the vice principal bustled in and called for us to please stand for morning prayers.
Stay strong, Finn messaged, his usual parting words.
I tucked my phone back into my pocket, and as the sea of girls rose around me, I stayed seated, head held high, sitting on my shaking hands and hoping my face wouldn't go up in flames. Afterward, I waited by the doors for the two seniors who had organised last week's protests. I handed them the leaflets I'd had Rachel print the day before. A record of sources and numbers. The list of every Magdalen laundry, every church-sanctioned mother and baby home, every Christian Brothers industrial school ever opened in the country, alongside the recent dates that each had closed. A call for our school to secularise our education. A student petition to separate church and state. Please stand up to do away with morning prayers, it said.
It garnered almost 200 signatures before it was confiscated. The pictures of the leaflets made their way online, were circulated so widely, our school ended up, again, on local news pages. Schoolgirls confiscated history at Magdalene Laundries goes viral. Secondary school students demand accountability of the church. Beyond gossip and selfies, teen girls petition for separation of church and state. I carried their stories with me. Mary Ellen and Anne, Julia, Rachel and Mandy. They were less of a weight and more a reminder that the truth could be hard to hear, but was the only thing that brought us together. "That and the banshees," said Ida, flicking through the letters I'd written in Mandy's handwriting, propped up on one elbow on my bed. She was visiting for the weekend. I decided she'd drop by every month or so. "Someone has to keep an eye on this crazy family," she'd said. Cale had also persuaded her grandparents to let her visit regularly, though it wasn't to keep an eye on anybody's family. "I wonder, are all legends kind of warped?" I said to Ida. "The scream of a banshee is supposed to foretell a death, but really, it's a warning. They're supposed to be evil ghosts, but they only ever wanted to help. At least, I think so." "I bet if the banshees were men, the myths wouldn't have gotten it wrong." "Huh." I watched her touch Mary Ellen's name. Julia's. "It's always the fault of the women, isn't it? They weren't the ones who wrote history." "True. But they found ways to pass their stories down." We typed up our family history. We'd sent it to my grandfather, to the rest of our family who weren't Rices, but who needed to be told nonetheless. Probably there were similar stories in the history of my grandmother's side of the family. Mandy agreed that, curse or no curse, she'd start her new research there. We'd sent our stories to Lizzie, Julia's sister, now a very old lady. We'd sent them to her children and great-grandchildren, who were of an age with me and Ida. They'd gotten in touch, contributed stories of their own. We planned to meet in Sligo all together, a Rice family reunion, to honour the lives of those who came before. We invited my grandfather, but did not expect him to come. "Okay," said Ida, gathering up the letters. "Time to go." We met Finn at the wooden bridge, walked down the path by the Dollymount Strand to the statue of Mary, where Cale was waiting. On the mosaic stones at the base of the statue, she had set out her candles and crystals, her unlabeled glass bottles full of a sweet, cloudy liquid. We took each other's hands, and I stood to say my prayer. "Our Lady, Star of the Sea, watch over the boats to England, watch over the plains, bless the places with clinics and small pills. Bless the bleeding women. Bless their tears and their relief. Our Lady, Star of the Sea, watch over the women. Watch over their passage home and erase their shame. Watch over the journeys, 11 every day as it was in the beginning, and hopefully will not always be. Amen." I twisted my hands out of my friend's grips, took two steps, and threw myself into the water. I surfaced, newly baptized by the sea at Dublin Bay. In a heartbeat, my friends emptied their pockets, left their phones and their wallets with the candles, and with three great jumps, their screams like banshees echoing across the Irish Sea, followed me.
Author's note. Dublin, 2018. I wrote the first draft of this novel in a very different Ireland from the one in which I write this now. In June 2016, when I first sat down to plot and research the history of the Rice Women, about a year before I would start writing it all into Dina's story, excavations were beginning to be carried out under the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation on the site of the Bon Secour Mother and Baby Home in Choom, County Galway. In the 1970s, two schoolboys found human remains in the grounds of the old home. The church vehemently denied that the remains were linked to the home and said that what the boys had found was most likely a famine grave. In 2012, local historian Catherine Corliss began a self-funded investigation into the deaths of babies and children in the Bon Secour Mother and Baby Home. She uncovered the names of 796 infants and children who had died in the home between 1925 and 1961, paid €4 each for every death record of those 796 children, and discovered that none of them were buried in local cemeteries. The children's and babies' death records suggested that many had died of malnutrition and neglect. Catherine Corliss put forward the idea that the remains found in the 1970s were not part of a famine grave, but were those of the children who died in the home, who were then buried in an unmarked grave in a vault in an old septic tank. 796 children means that one child died in that one mother and baby home every 2 weeks. This is not fiction. This is not a story. This all happened in living memory. This novel was, in part, fueled by rage. The last Magdalene laundry in Ireland closed in 1996. It's estimated that 30,000 to 35,000 women and girls were incarcerated in these Catholic-run institutions, with over 11,000 since 1922. Some were sent by social workers because the families could not care for them. Some from reformatory schools. Some by the police. Many were transferred straight from mother and baby homes after they'd given birth. Some were sent because they'd suffered abuse or mental illness. Some accounts are from women who were sent because they were disobedient, because they were too pretty, for having a boyfriend, for being gay. Most of the history of the Magdalene laundries relies on first-person accounts because, in a series of strange coincidences, almost all the records of these places held by church officials are either missing or were mysteriously destroyed before official investigations could be carried out. There is still no separation of church and state in Ireland. It was only in 2018 that our constitutional ban on blasphemy was repealed. It is only in 2019 that primary schools' baptism barrier will be removed, meaning that schools will no longer be allowed to deny non-Catholic children a place on the basis of religion or lack thereof. It is only in 2019 that a pregnant person will be able to access safe, legal abortion in this country. Throughout this novel, I have used the words mother and women when talking about people who can become pregnant, because the focus of the book was on the women in Dina's family in particular. But I want to emphasise that trans men, genderqueer and non-binary folks, not just cis women, can and do get pregnant and need to be included in the continuing fight for reproductive rights. All the Bad Apples is set in 2012, the year in which Savita Halappanavar died in a maternity hospital in Galway after having been denied the abortion that would have saved her life. When she requested a termination, after having learned that she was suffering a septic miscarriage, she was reportedly told that Ireland is a Catholic country. Up until May 2018, when the people of this Catholic country, fueled by a grassroots feminist movement that called for a referendum, voted overwhelmingly in favour of repealing the Eighth Amendment, abortion was illegal in Ireland, punishable by up to 14 years in prison. This included abortion in cases of pregnancy as a result of incest or rape, abortion in the case of fatal fetal abnormalities, and, until 2013, abortion in cases where the pregnancy was directly endangering the pregnant person's life. The Eighth Amendment of the Constitution of the Republic of Ireland gave equal right to life to the pregnant person and the unborn. After a High Court trial known as the X case, Attorney General versus X, in 1992, in which a 14-year-old girl, suicidal because of a pregnancy as a result of rape, was initially restrained from leaving the state for a period of 9 months so as to stop her accessing abortion services overseas. Pregnant people were granted the freedom to travel to procure an abortion and the freedom to obtain information about abortion services overseas. It is estimated that since 1992, 12 women travel outside the country every day to terminate their pregnancies legally. This is a different Ireland, but the past is still so close. The stigma, the shame, the silence of generations complicit in the institutional abuse and neglect of its people. The places in this book are not all real places, but they are inspired by real places. The characters are not real people, but they are inspired by real people's stories. There's great power in sharing stories, in connecting, in speaking truths, in bringing abuses to light. To read real stories of people who've had to travel to procure abortions, please visit In Her Shoes, Women of the Eighth, www.facebook.com/InHerIrishShoes. A Facebook page created to share anonymous stories of real people travelling abroad for abortions. To read real-life accounts of survivors of Magdalen laundries and mother and baby homes, please visit the Magdalen Oral History Project, created by the Justice for Magdalens group. jfmresearch.com/home/Oral History Project. Cry. Rage. Speak out. Break the stigma. Break the curse. If you or someone you know has been affected by any of the issues raised in this book, please remember you're not alone. The following organizations can help: National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, suicidepreventionlifeline.org, 1-800-273-8255. National Sexual Assault Hotline, www.rainn.org, 1-800-656-4673. The Trevor Project, Saving Young LGBTQ Lives, www.thetrevorproject.org, 1-866-488-7386. Planned Parenthood, www.plannedparenthood.org, 1-800-230-7526.
This is Marisa Collin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of All the Bad Apples by Moira Fowley Doyle. This programme was directed by Paula Parker. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2019 by Moira Fowley Doyle. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.